It's 1 o'clock, and I'm going to call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It's the last Friday in January, and as a reminder, please silence your cell phones. And if you need to make a phone call or anything like that, please step out of the room. And same goes ideally if you have to text somebody, do that outside the room too. It is now 1:01 p.m. on Friday, January 27, 2017, and we have here with us today Representative Kopp, Representative Eastman, Representative Ledoux, my Vice Chair Representative Fansler, and myself, Representative Clayman, and we have Representative Grant in the room, who will be joining us and also presenting the bill. Representative Reinbold is excused for the day, but she has indicated she may call in to participate. Representative Reinbold, are you online?
Yes.
All right, so Representative Reinbold is reflected, should be reflected as online today. And we do have a quorum to do business. Our first order of business is House Bill 44, Legislative Ethics, Voting in Conflicts, and House Concurrent Resolution Number 1, Amend Uniform Rules, Abstain from Voting, sponsored by Representative Grimm. This is the first hearing on the bill and concurrent resolution, and they will be heard jointly. There is a proposed sponsor's substitute to House Bill 44. Can I have a motion to adopt the sponsor's substitute as a working document?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the House Judiciary Committee adopt the sponsor substitute to House Bill 44 as our working document.
Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, the committee adopts the sponsor substitute to House Bill 44. Representative Grimm, bill sponsor, and any staff you'd like to come forward, can you come forward and tell us about the bill? And if you can identify yourselves for the record and then begin your presentation.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the Judiciary Committee. For the record, I'm Representative Jason Grimm, proudly serving District 22 in South Anchorage. I appreciate the opportunity to present these important pieces of legislation. Before I get started, I would like to notify members that Jerry Anderson, the Committee Administrator for the Legislative Ethics Committee, and Doug Gardner, the Director of the Division of Legal and Research Services, are joining us on the line today and will be available to answer questions throughout the hearing.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So the intent of the two bills before you are to increase transparency within the state legislature and allow the public to see what we do with the utmost certainty that conflict of interests are taken seriously. As we ask the public to trust us with our votes, these pieces of legislation add small but important steps to increasing the transparency that our constituents expect from us. Currently, the Alaska State Legislature uses a system of absentation that allows for no record of why a person was not allowed to abstain. A single objection can be raised, and a legislator requesting to abstain is required to vote. Alaska is the only state in the country to require a unanimous consent to allow of an absentation from voting. The two pieces of legislation before you do not allow for a legislator to be excused from voting on an appropriation bill. These two pieces of legislation do not take away a legislator's ability to vote on the budget. As we legislators guide Alaska through these troubled times, increasing the public's trust is more important than ever, and creating transparency is critical. HB 44 establishes a clear and concise standard for legislators to use when they are determining if they have a conflict in line with existing statutes. HCR 1 does that with a vote on the public record. I will now defer to my staff, Ryan Johnston, to walk members through the bill.
Mr. Johnston, if you could also state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 44.
Tell us your name first.
This is my first time, and I put it too far down in my script. My name is Ryan Johnston, staff representative Jason Grimm. I will begin with a sectional analysis of HB 44 and then move on to HCR 1. House Bill 44 version O has six sections. A sectional analysis has been included in your packet for those of you who would like to follow along. Section 1 outlines the conflict of interest standards from which a legislator may vote on a particular issue. Conflict is defined as a substantial benefit or harm to the financial interests of a legislator's immediate family member, a legislator's employer, an immediate family member's employer, a person with whom the legislator is negotiating employment, or from whom the legislator or immediate family member has received more than $10,000 in income within the last 12 months. Section 2 outlines that a legislator may not vote on a question in a committee and must request to abstain from voting on the floor if the legislator or immediate family member has a substantial financial interest. A legislator may vote on an appropriations bill that meets the requirements the appropriation statutes AS 3707-020A or AS 3707-100, the Executive Budget Act. Section 3 defines substantially benefit or harm as the effect of the person's financial interest being greater than the effect of the financial interest of a substantial class of persons to which the person belongs as a member of a profession, occupation, industry, or region. Section 4 defines fiscal interest as ownership of an interest or involvement in a business, property ownership, or relationship that is a source of income and financial benefit. Section 5 provides that this act only takes effect upon passage of House Concurrent Resolution 1, amending Uniform Rules 34B. And finally, Section 6 provides for an effective date later than that of the resolution to Uniform Rule 34B referred to in Section 5. And now moving on to HCR 1. Section 1 amends the rule to state that a legislator may abstain from a vote with a majority consent. Currently, Uniform Rule 34B states that a legislator may abstain from a vote by a unanimous consent. It also amends the rule or Uniform Rule to include two instances when a member may not vote. A legislator may not vote on their own abstention from a vote, and a legislator may not vote on an issue if the body casts a majority vote for the legislator to abstain. I have also included...
Could just for a brief interruption, if the record could reflect that Representative Christ Tompkins has joined us. Thank you, if you can proceed.
I've also included for you a flowchart. So if you'd like to follow along, which includes the current procedure for a legislator to abstain and what the procedure would look like with the implementation of House Bill 44 and House Concurrent Resolution 1. If you'd like to follow along quickly, under current procedures, a legislator believes they have a conflict of interest under AS 2460-030. The legislator then stands on the floor, declares the conflict, and asks to abstain. And then a unanimous consent is needed to allow for the legislator to abstain. If the consent is given, the legislator abstains and does not vote, or an objection is raised and the legislator must vote and the objection is not recorded in the journal of that day. Moving on to the procedures under the implementation of House Bill 44 and House Concurrent Resolution 1. A legislator believes they have a conflict of interest under AS 2460-030 with the new language from HB 44. And then that legislator stands on the floor, declares their conflict. They will explain the conflict and ask to abstain. A majority consent is now needed for the legislator to abstain. If the majority vote is cast in consenting to the abstention, the legislator does not vote, and that record is then recorded in the journal for that day. If there is not a majority vote cast for consent, then the legislator must vote, and the vote denying the abstention is then recorded in the journal for that day. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that concludes my prepared testimony. Thank you again for the opportunity, and we welcome any questions the committee may have at this time.
Thank you for that presentation, and I'll take questions from the committee. And I would know Representative Reinbold, because I can't see you waving your hand because you're on the phone. Just let us know and we'll give you a chance in the queue.
Thank you.
Representative Wadu.
Excuse me. Through the chair. Any idea why the person who has objected isn't recorded in the journal?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe that's how the statute, it's an almost unwritten rule that someone always stands up, and so an unwritten rule would not need to be in any statute, but that's how the statute reads now, that there's no record of it.
The statute itself reads that there's no record of it?
Through the chair, Representative LeBlanc, there's no language to that in the statute.
There's no language one way or the other in the statute.
Through the chair, Representative LeBlanc, through our research, correct.
Thank you.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Grant is probably referring to a uniform rule rather than the statute that Representative LeBlanc was talking about. And if I may, Mr. Chair, with a question.
Yes, go ahead. I didn't think that was a question.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Grin, I think what we all want there to be good transparency in public process. One of the things that I would just like us to think about collectively is unintended consequences. If a majority consent is needed to allow for the legislator to abstain, can you imagine a situation where a bill that is important to the majority would decide that we agree that someone in the minority has a conflict and we're all going to vote that that person does and kind of vote on party lines versus how they really feel if that person has an interest that is greater than someone else in their class of people that are similarly situated? I'm just trying to imagine situations where it could be a majority-minority split based on how this bill is written. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, yes, we appreciate looking through those scenarios, and we've talked about that. Where we came to on this coming to a majority vote was one through other research, how the other 49 states deal with conflict of interest. They deal with it in different manners, but a vast majority of them deal with a majority vote of the body. But we also looked at Alaska statute, and where the Alaska statute, and I can list that for you, I think Ryan will grab that, where we ask municipalities to handle conflict of interest with a majority vote to allow them to abstain or not. Our Anchorage Assembly deals through conflict of interest that way. Our belief was that the Alaska legislature should meet what we're asking municipalities to do as well. But you're right. This does not take some of the politics out of what can happen. Our hope is that our colleagues would recognize that someone's vote is the most important thing they can do as a legislature. And to take that away from someone for political reasons or vindictive reasons or anything, we can't deal with that through legislation. And that's through this current proposal anyways. But we agree that there could be scenarios where what you've talked about potentially could happen. What we're wanting to have done through this is create a public record of the vote. And so if a legislature asks, they bring up their conflict of interest, and one side or the other wants to play politics, and they want to vote party lines, well, that vote now is public record. And the public can see that one side or the other is engaging in politics as opposed to good policy. And that's what the transparency layer does, is add it to so the public knows what we're doing when we're on the floor as legislators.
Follow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Representative Grin, good answer. More unintended consequences discussion. Alaska has a citizen legislature. We all do other jobs. Some of them most legislators have had long professional backgrounds in the public and or private sector, and their constituents know that. Certainly APOC disclosed it, and they are elected because they bring a perspective and a viewpoint by their constituents into the public arena of discussion and ideas on public policy ideas. So, is there, you know, in the declaration of your conflict, which we have to do now, right? I mean, we have to stand up and we have to declare that on the floor now. So it's on the record that you have a conflict. So the only difference is now you're absolutely calling for the vote every time. And in my thinking this through, I'm thinking of our commercial fishermen. I'm thinking of our people that are involved in fish buying. So we could have like a fish tax bill, or we could have a bill that has to do with the legal field. Maybe even would affect your clientele. It's easy to focus on private sector, but there are attorneys in the legislature. Maybe they have a class of people they represent that exceeds $10,000 considerably in what they get from that group that they represent. And again, it would come back to maybe how does the majority feel about the bill and how does the minority feel, but who their clients are and who they are in their profession is very important. And they are elected by their districts because people really, you know, believe in them, and they want that perspective represented. So sometimes we can take an action and we think we're you know, reducing finger pointing and increasing the flow of process, but I'm just trying to think of how this might be an unintended stumbling block based on the fact that we do have a citizen legislature and people do come out of various backgrounds and interests, and I'd like to hear your comments on that. Thank you, Mr. Sherman.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, everything you said I agree with. You know, I think what makes Alaska great through our government process is that we do have a citizen legislature with people of various backgrounds and extensive experience, and this is a 90-day job, but it's still a full-time job the rest of the year, you know, when we work with our constituents. Through our research, looking at other citizen legislatures and how they deal with conflict of interests, we found in New Mexico, they get no salary as a state legislator. They get per diem, but their salary is actually, you know, no dollars per year. And to us, that's really the epitome of a citizen legislature. They obviously have other incomes, other jobs that they use for their life. And using their statute, looking at their conflict of interest, it's very much like what we're proposing. And in some ways, actually, it's a little stricter. They go into more things regarding stocks, percentages of what percentage of business owned. We didn't go into some of those details, but we did want to match something of other citizen legislatures, like you mentioned. And I think if we go back to the bill where it says, you know, we're talking particular lawyers or other cases, these are bills that would substantially benefit you as a legislator, more so than the rest of the class maybe you're representing, or more so than the rest of the class that this legislation goes towards. When we start getting into hypotheticals and examples, I would, you know, if Doug Gardner, who's director of legal and research services, if he's online, if he could answer to some of those hypotheticals, I'd appreciate it. My lifeline for the day.
Representative Kopp, follow up or?
Well, I'll do a truly a question, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would like to hear from a legal on if I had a class of clients that I was representing. You know, maybe they're anything from bargaining units, or they're, I mean, I could just think of a whole host of things where I'm getting more than $10,000 in income. So
how about a group? And I represent each one who's next in the queue, but to okay. try to yeah. focus the discussion, I can offer, why don't I offer three different hypotheticals, and okay. then we'll see okay. how he responds.
Yeah. So those are my thoughts, and maybe you could help with getting that from out of Ledger Legal for an opinion. Thank you.
So let's take, I'll take three different hypotheticals. The first hypothetical, let's say I work for ARCO Petroleum, no longer involved in Norcell, but I work for ARCO Petroleum, and my salary with ARCO, in addition to serving on the legislature, and for the note, I don't work for ARCO today, never have, but if I'm working for ARCO and my salary is more than $10,000, and there's a oil and gas tax credit bill that's in front of the legislature that doesn't just affect ARCO but affects any oil company that might be doing business in Alaska, how would this
how would this amendment to the statutes impact me? Would I have a basis to stand up and say, Falco paid me more than $10,000 last year, I'd get a conflict? You're answering the chair. No, you're just answering the chair.
To the chair, our proposal, you would not have a conflict of interest.
And why not?
Again, going back, for us, the main kind of the pivot on this is found.
And if you want your lifeline with Mr. Gardner, you can pull the lifeline too.
Brian has the right page. So, Mr. Chair, there wouldn't be a conflict because Ryan Johnston, staff representative of Grimm. There wouldn't be a conflict because your ARCO is not substantially being benefited or harmed more than the rest of the industry. If the oil taxes were equal across the board, there's no caveat in the bill that ARCO gets X amount more than any other company. If it's just straight across, taxes are equal for every business, then no, you would not have a substantial benefit or harm to your employer, so you would not have a conflict of interest.
Okay. So with a slightly different hypothetical, but similar, and this will be involving a labor union, let's say I work for the laborers union, whatever number it is, and I get paid more than $10,000 a year, and there's a bill in front of the legislature that specifically says laborers union X will be treated a certain way in this legislation. How would that impact under this particular conflict of interest bill?
Mr. Chairman, if it's talking about laborers union X and it's excluding all other laborers and
all other unions, right.
Other unions, then you would need to disclose your conflict of interest and rise to that tell the body that you have a conflict of interest. My belief under what it proposes.
And then the legislature would then vote yea or nay whether to accept that conflict.
Correct, yes, Mr. Chair. Based on then your explanation of the conflict.
Correct. Okay. And then I'll ask a third question kind of related to what Representative Cobb had suggested. So let's say, I am a lawyer, so let's say one of my clients is ARCO, and ARCO pays my firm and me more than $10,000 in a given year, and ARCO has a bill that's tax credit specific to ARCO. We're no longer dealing with the whole industry, but now it's just ARCO, and I work for ARCO, but ARCO doesn't employ me. They pay whatever the name of my firm is. What happens then? I think that gets to the question.
Mr. Chair, I think in some of these hypotheticals, especially when it comes to some privileged confidentiality where a lawyer might have, I would like to see if Doug Gardner would be able to answer a hypothetical like that.
Mr. Gardner, you on the line?
Representative Kleeman, through the chair, I think that, I'm an attorney and a member of the bar, as you are, Representative Kleeman. If I had to answer that question, if I was a legislator and I had to get up and declare a conflict, I think I would declare that conflict because the vote that I place might directly benefit a client, and ultimately I get paid by that client. So I'd rise to that. But I don't think that I would need to disclose any confidentiality. I think I could rise to that and say, Mr. Speaker, I declare a conflict. I work, my employment as an attorney involves representation of in the oil and gas tax area, and this bill may create a conflict for me. But I think you can do it topically in such a way as to avoid the disclosure of different individual clients. I don't think I have to get up under the hypothetical and say, ARCO's my main client. I think there's a way to address that without having to get into the attorney-client and representation confidentiality piece. And so, sitting here listening, I've been trying to construct a hypothetical where you would have to disclose a client. I haven't come up with one just yet, but I bet it's out there. Anyway, that's my comment.
Okay, so now I've tossed down three. I'm going to send it back to Representative Copley. Do you have follow-up questions on those?
Owen.
I think Representative Eastman was next in the queue. Representative Eastman.
Through the chair. Now, I can't really ask my question unless I ask a prefatory question. So, in your bill, you state effect on a substantial class of persons. And I know in the portions of the bill that you're changing, I don't necessarily find that defined anywhere. Is that defined elsewhere? What's the intent? What are you trying to get at? What substantial class of persons? And how specific is that currently defined in statute?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman.
Just remind us who you are.
Oh, Ryan Johnston, staff, Representative Grant. I'll get it eventually. I apologize. So it is in the current version, version O, and from the previous statute, if you go to line 27, belongs as a member of a profession, occupation, industry, or region, and that's really what we're talking to about with that being part of the group, like you brought up, Representative Eastman. It's the substantial number within your industry, X amount of businesses, and that's where we derived our language from, was from statute. We tried to do as much as we could from already existing statute.
And what's your understanding of, through the chair, what's your understanding of what substantial means? How many is substantial? How much is substantial?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I mean, that is where the discretionary part falls in with a legislator choosing to rise. I mean, it's I know it's not a great answer to give, but it leaves it to the discretionary choice of the legislator. I mean, each business is different, each industry is different, region is different as well. But we substantial would have to be a good portion, we would say, of your industry. If you were part of three businesses being affected, and there's 80 businesses left out, we would say that was substantial.
Well, further follow-up, go ahead.
Through the chair. All right. In that case. So let me put it to you this way. So currently, as it stands, without this bill coming forward, it is difficult to abstain from a vote. There's not a lot of precedent for abstentions, and you would make it a little bit easier to abstain from a vote. But now, on the other hand, there's never been an instance that I'm aware of where we have forbidden a legislator from casting a vote, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in the current language you have here, I think you put forth two situations where a legislator would actually, by law, be forbidden from casting a vote, and I wonder if that kind of seems to be cross purposes from the idea of permitting someone to abstain. I myself was surprised when I, was first learning about the legislature that members were not permitted to simply abstain. But I wonder how many other examples are you using or inspired this requirement that you'd come to a situation where by law you would actually prohibit a legislator from abstaining or from voting rather.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we're not actually forbidding anyone from voting. All we're doing is constructing a standard for them to talk about their conflict of interest and ask to abstain themselves, and then putting that vote to the body of the membership. So we're not saying you are forbidden based on this. We're saying you might have a conflict of interest that needs to be then discussed.
Representative
the chair, didn't I just hear it presented that there would be two different types of situations where a legislator, for example, in voting on their own abstention, would be legally prohibited from casting a vote for their district?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Grin, the two instances are, one has to do with the legislator in question voting on their own abstention, and to us, and looking at other states' statute, it makes no practical sense to allow them to vote on their own abstention. So in that situation, and they shouldn't be allowed to vote. And this is under uniform rules. This is a uniform rules change, and that's one of the things we've been dealing with, is we have to change the uniform rule to allow for this abstention to happen. And then, yes, then the second situation, the legislator is granted an abstention from voting, not forbidden to vote, but after they're granted an abstention, they must abide by that abstention and not vote. So I wouldn't say they were forbidden to vote, but they've asked for an abstention and then been granted that abstention, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
I'm pleased that this issue is being addressed, because I've thought for a long time that there's a problem here. But I'm wondering whether or not other states and municipalities, for example, have far broader rationales for letting people abstain. And I guess some of the examples that the chair posited, I would have expected somebody to be viewed as having a conflict of interest, because I remember, for example, that in the municipality there was someone who had, and I can't remember who it was, but he was involved in the cannabis industry, and there were regulations or ordinances relating to that industry, and I think he was not allowed to vote on that, even though the ordinance in question didn't relate specifically to his business. And I'm trying to think around here some of the things and some of the votes that may have been viewed as a conflict of interest that somebody might have wanted to abstain from. And I can think of virtually no instances, and I'm sure there would be some, in which it was a law that specifically related to just one business or one union, for example. So let's just say a person was working for a union, and there was right to work legislation before the legislature. I mean, it would seem to me that there would be a conflict in voting on that legislation. And yet it's sounding to me from your answers that would be perfectly appropriate under this bill for that person to continue to vote on that legislation.
To the chair, Representative Ledoux, you're right in that there's states that have and municipalities that have a lot stricter parameters of what a conflict of interest entails. We took, through our research, and what we wanted to do was to make this a starting place that adds, at least from our perspective, some transparency to how votes take place and what constitutes as a conflict of interest. Looking through, I think it's in your packets that we have a list, I believe, of what the threshold is of a number of other states. If you own 5% of a company, if that company is involved with the bill, you would have to declare a conflict of interest. We didn't go to some of those thresholds. For us, we're trying to take what we believe to be small steps in adding to the transparency of how we declare conflict of interests and what's public record.
We've got a queue going. Hold on. And I know, Representative Reingold, I see that you'd like to ask a question. You're in the queue. Go ahead. This is a response, I think.
Actually, not Representative Rangel, I'll call on you in a bit. You're about four down in the queue, but I think Mr. Johnston is going to add to what Representative Grimm just said.
Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Grimm. And I think the issue you're pointing to, Representative Ledoux, is the rank and file kind of issue. I mean, if you were an everyday electrician in your hypothetical, and you were part of that union, and you believed in you didn't believe in right to work and you wanted to vote against it, it poses the question of, is it the substantial benefit or harm to you? And if you feel like the right to work is substantially going to harm you as an everyday electrician, then you might feel the need to rise and declare that conflict of interest. We're not saying that you have this out because that you're not owning 5% of a business, but if you're a rank and file member and you feel like that legislation is going to harm you, you would have that option to rise and declare that conflict.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
So what about if you're not a rank and file member? Suppose you're the president of the union, but it impacts all unions. You still, under this bill, it doesn't sound like, I mean, maybe you'd get up and you would declare a conflict, but if your analysis of this bill is correct, then there'd be no reason for anybody to vote that you do have a conflict, because you're not impacted more substantially than any of the other unions in the state.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, from what we proposed, you're correct.
So, just one follow-up. Sure. So if somebody were to consider an amendment tightening that threshold, would you consider that a friendly or an unfriendly amendment?
Representative, we always assume that amendments from you are friendly, but we'll let them answer anyway.
through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that would be correct, I guess, for the body to decide.
Or at least this committee.
Or the committee, correct.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This feels like a baton pass because my line of thinking and inquiry is very similar to Representative Ledoux's. And actually, I think the question I want to ask might be best directed not so much to the bill sponsor, just given the relative longitudinal perspective I think that this question will rely on, but perhaps Mr. Gardner of Legislative Legal Services. And I think similar to what Representative Ledoux was homing in on, it's my impression that the way the legislature has operated, at least in my own relatively short tenure here, we have, by tradition, I guess, or etiquette, interpreted the conflict of interest rules and uniform rules to be more stringent, I guess, than the actual letter of the conflict of interest rules are, because we often rise to disclose a conflict of interest, even if we, what is the letter of the law here, don't have a conflict that is rises to the level that is greater than the effect on a substantial class of persons, as Representative Eastman was asking about. In other words, that just a regular rank-and-file union member might rise to disclose a conflict on general, generic, labor-related legislation or fishing or legal field or whatever. And so I guess to maybe confirm this understanding, I wanted to ask Mr. Gardner, is that your impression from having observed lots of members rise and disclose conflicts in the House floor that in many instances, or even I want to ask, in the majority of instances, are members disclosing conflicts when they're not actually obligated to by the letter of the uniform rules?
Mr. Gardner?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, I want to be careful. I don't want to comment on, I'll make a general comment. I don't want this to be, you know, focused on any particular time period or legislators. But I think that in the recent past, the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics has issued a couple of opinions that have found violations for failures to disclose, particularly in the areas where legislators have a contract, for a state or a service, and ultimately they're voting on a budget or an appropriation vehicle. And so I think those legislative ethics committee opinions may have driven a concern. Clearly, the consequence of not declaring the conflict and being found in violation of the ethics laws, it brings with it quite a lot of stigma, probably from a political standpoint. But more than that, it can have a very significant impact. You can be fined. You could theoretically be expelled from the legislature. Very extreme. Unlikely, probably, in most cases. But I do think there has been a trend towards considerable disclosure. You're probably recalling circumstances where on the House floor in the last several years that leadership have stood up and made comments about the scope of needing to disclose. There were a very large number of disclosures in the last 2 years, as I recall it. So yes, there's probably been more disclosure. Having said that, a legislator is probably wise to disclose because the net result, as you've observed, is that there's usually an objection to an abstention from voting. And in the end, the legislator votes. And because the ethics statute is ultimately made subordinate to the uniform rules, a uniform rule decision and an abstention objection exonerates the legislator from any conflict, and perhaps that process in the end does what it's intended to do, and it allows constituents and the public and other legislators to know where that legislator is coming from, that yes, they do provide this service, or they are an attorney for a particular group of clients, and in the end it's out there. But the person is required to vote and represent their constituents. So I think that's the balance that's been going on, and that balance has shifted a little bit more, Representative Chris Tompkins, in terms of disclosure in the last several years, and that's my thought process on why.
Follow up?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Not to deprive Representative Lintier, looks like she has thoughts. I was going to say, it's my impression, well, maybe just to clarify the discussion, because I think the hypotheticals that Representative Kopp brought up and Representative Klingman expounded on are important, and I guess this is kind of a learning experience for me that actually it's kind of a minimalistic, just right now, independent of your bill, the letter of the uniform rule right now is rather minimalistic, and I'm a little bit surprised about it, actually. And so I guess I think maybe important for us in considering this legislation to recognize that actually maybe this is sort of a standing issue, and the hypothetical amendment Representative Ledoux you're talking about might have merit even independent of your legislation. So I was just going to say that seems to make a lot of sense to me, that this substantial classes clause kind of throws a curveball into this and waters down the conflict of interest disclosure rules in a way that surprises me.
So was that just a comment and not a question?
I guess it was. Yeah,
okay, that's fine. Representative Fancy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I guess I'll hop on the train of all of my colleagues, kind of under the unintended consequences situation. It sounds like, and I think what my fellow colleagues up here are also talking about is there a worry that this may actually result in a suppression of people declaring a conflict of interest because of the clause that we're referring to?
Through the chair, Representative Mansler, this again puts a bar that would require someone to stand for a conflict of interest. This doesn't take away from someone being overly cautious or wanting to stand to declare a conflict to be safe. This just sets a standard that we feel is that can be followed a little bit better, and the public can know what the bar is.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
As a follow up to the chair, you know, I think we tried kind of hard in our examples to come up with examples where someone may have to declare a conflict of interest, and you'll forgive me, I'm a freshman, so I don't know every bill that's passed through every chamber, but I personally am having a difficult time envisioning bills that are going to selectively single out one or two entities in a class in which that might happen. And if I recall correctly, you said when we started this that we're kind of the only state that doesn't have these kinds of laws on the books, and that was part of your idea for this, which I applaud. I like uniformity. Do you have any statistics on the number of conflicts of interest that are declared in and most specifically anyone that has this type of clause in it, the substantial group clause? And also, do you have any statistics on the number of times after that conflict has been declared that the majority has then voted to allow them to abstain, or how that's worked?
Ryan Johnston, Representative Gren's staff. Through the chair, Representative Vanzler, we've reached out to states and we're just waiting to hear back on that, so hopefully by Monday I can have more of those statistics for you.
Thank you.
Representative Reingold, you're next in the queue.
Thank you, Chair Klayman, and I appreciate you allowing me to testify online. I was attending the Justice Commission, as you were, at today's teleconferencing, and then today I'm doing an APD ride-along from 3 to 11, so I thank you for excuse, but I also excuse the essence, but I'm very happy to be participating online. So first of all, I want to thank the sponsor of the bill. I do think that the intent of the bill is one worth vetting. I have, the more I think about it, the more concerns that are raised, and I do appreciate and having the opportunity to ask him a few questions today, and there will be plenty more. But the sponsor of the bill, Representative Gren, I'm wondering, is there any subjectivity at all to this bill? For example, some may have a more sensitive conscience than others, and I know we've discussed this bill in the past, and what my understanding of our discussion was is, yes, there's subjectivity. And I would like you just to discuss what concerns you have in regard to possibly some people rising versus other ones not rising.
Representative Gren.
Through the chair, Representative Reinfeld. We currently have a process in place through our ethics committee that if someone wishes to lodge a complaint because of a undisclosed conflict, we currently have that process in place. It's happened not just through votes on the floor, but in other instances, and we've talked with them. They've given us some statistics, but it's also confidential information. But there is a process in place that if someone feels that something is not disclosed, they can complain, file a complaint, and that process happens. It works. There's well-known stories regarding some of those complaints in Alaska's history, and as mentioned, that there's a process for that instance.
Representative Reingold, any follow-up?
I actually do.
Go ahead.
As far as to financial disclosures, I know Representative Gren, we talked, and he's not done a financial disclosure, but those are all on record, and they're all public record. And that was another level to increase transparency and trust in the public, that we put all that out there. And many people choose to not run for office because they don't want to do that. But once he goes through that process, I think that he will realize that there is a lot more transparency in the process than he may understand at this point. And I have discussed this with him. Well, my concern is the subjectivity, where some people's sensitivities are far more since it's the standing up and declaring conflict of interest versus other, and the ethics process is a more quiet process, and it's very time-consuming, so I would definitely like to discuss that in regards to the subjectivity. And also, the elephant in the room for many people is some know that your caucus is very interested in changing oil and gas tax policies. And as you know, historically, the oil and gas industry has contributed about 90% to the state budget. Just want to make sure, I want to ask Representative Grant if there's any among the 11 co-sponsors or any caucus members or yourself, is there any motivation in any way to alienate or target anybody associated with the oil and gas industry?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, thank you for the question. You know, as a freshman legislator, watching government take place from the outside before I was elected, I always wished and hoped that the 40 people in our body, the 20 people in the other body, would act in a way that is always mindful of being integrity-filled and honest and open with everything that we do. My motivation for putting this legislation forward is one from a policy perspective, but also very personal. From a policy standpoint, again, we're the only state that allows it to go this way when you're asking to abstain, and I believe that we can always improve things that add to the transparency and build the public trust. From a personal standpoint, when the day I filed to run for office was the day I actually had to resign from my job because of a perceived conflict of interest. So I take it very personally when we talk about being open and honest and transparent. It was something that I believe the public wants more of and demands more of, and if we're doing things well, we can always do things better. But from my intent, when I filed this bill, I didn't talk to anyone in my caucus. I didn't talk to anyone outside of my staff members of what the purpose we could do with this bill. As mentioned, it was something very personal to me, as I had to resign from my job from a perceived conflict of interest. And I believe that as legislators, we can always put ourselves to a higher standard when it comes to building trust with the public. So to answer your question directly, no, this is not meant towards anyone in this building in particular, not towards any in the industry or region in Alaska. Really, for us, it was about setting guidelines for future legislatures, really, giving them a path and knowledge of what a conflict of interest might be, and to put that discussion and a vote on that discussion on public record as another way to add a layer of transparency to what we're doing in Juneau.
Any further follow-up, Representative Randall?
Thank you, Chairman. So basically, just to reiterate or paraphrase what you said, you've had no discussion amongst your caucus, no discussion amongst any of the 11 co-sponsors, and that this is not targeting in any way any member that's associated with the oil and gas industry, and it has no intention of moving your caucus agenda forward. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Rumble, as I mentioned, I didn't discuss the pre-filing of this bill with anyone in my caucus. The intention was not, there's no target with this bill outside of wanting to build public trust and add transparency to what we do as 60 members of the legislature.
That's all. Thank you. Representative Cobb, you're next in the queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Grimm, on page 2 of the bill, on line 16 and 17, I'm concerned about the two standards we have on voting on those two lines. A legislator, and the standards are if you're in a committee or if you're on the House floor, a legislator may not vote on a question before a committee of the legislature, comma, and shall request to be excused from voting on a question before a House of the legislature if you have a conflict. So, you know, if you're on the floor, you get to stand up and at least have your colleagues vote, right? But if you're in a committee, you lose your vote. And so along the friendly amendment lines. You know, it. You know, you were, one vote in the committee can be significant. Sometimes, you know, particularly in the other body, you may only have three people at the end of session. You're trying to, you got, you know, a lot going on at once, where it can be tough even to get a quorum. And everybody's vote is really important. So, just something to think about.
Ryan Johnson, staff representative Grant, through the chair, Representative Cobb. That is something that we've been talking about as an office as well, and we're open to it because it is an issue that we've run into, and we're more than willing to talk about it with a friendly amendment. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next, I have Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I ask for your leeway. I've got a number of questions.
Sure.
So the first question is for Doug Gardner. Doug, are you still around?
Mr. Gardner?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I am.
Thank you. So does the substantial interest test in this bill mirror what is required by the ethics rules? Or is it different? I mean, does the ethics rules require you to report just about everything? Or, so let's go back to the example of somebody who was working for a union and there was right-to-work legislation. Would the ethics rules require you to reveal that?
Probably not, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. I don't think so. I think that, you know, if we expanded the hypothetical a little bit and you know, as a member of maybe one of the larger state unions or maybe even a smaller boutique union, it seems to me that I think the ethics opinions that I've read and the thinking of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics is that, you know, if you're in with a substantial class of persons similarly situated and your interest is, you know, neither here nor there with respect to this issue, then I don't think that you would have to disclose in that circumstance. And so, but back to the question that was asked earlier, I suspect many legislators would choose to do so out of an abundance of caution, but I think technically you probably wouldn't need to in that circumstance.
What about, just follow up through.
Yeah, that's fine.
So it seems to me that when we were doing a tax bill way back, like about 10 years or so ago, that somebody ended up with some ethics problems for, I think, for not having declared a conflict before they voted when they were allegedly talking about employment with a company that was involved in oil field services. Is my recollection incorrect?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in there's an advisory opinion in preparing for this. I took a look at a couple of advisory opinions. And I don't know how much time the chair has here, but I can do this fairly quickly. There's an advisory opinion. It's numbered 2013-01. The issue is whether a member of the legislature who also worked for a natural resource in a company that made money extracting natural resources, whether or not there was a conflict in terms of voting on bills that might affect that industry. And it's a fact-intensive inquiry, but the takeaway is that the duties, the committee looked at the duties of the individual in relation to the company, weighed whether or not the legislative member who worked for this company had a key financial or just strategic decision-making position, whether their annual salary was compensated in the same as other members, and whether or not the person was frankly on unpaid leave from the employer during the session. And the committee came to the conclusion that there was no conflict in that situation. And so just because somebody works in an industry or has an association like the union situation that you mentioned, there's a factual inquiry, if you will, a little bit more of a drill down into exactly what interest that person has in that organization. And in the case of the 2013 advisory opinion, the answer was no conflict.
Thank you. Just one more question.
Go ahead.
Is there anything in the uniform rules right now that precludes the clerk from identifying the person who has made the objection? When somebody abstains, asks for unanimous consent to abstain from a vote.
This is a question for Doug Gardner. Mr. Gardner.
On a quick question and a quick answer, I think I'm right. But in the preparation of the journal, neither Uniform Rule 9, which instructs the clerk on what to include in the journal, and Uniform Rule 34, as I recall it sitting here, I don't think either of those, I think they're basically silent on this issue. I think the question may be past practice and precedent with respect to the chief clerk and the Senate secretary, including abstention requests or other aspects of that process in the journal. I know they're not included, but I think that's past practice and precedent. So the answer, I think, is no. But I will follow up if I find out something else later.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman, you're next.
Thank you. Through the chair. Let me ask the question and then explain sort of what I'm getting at. So when you, under this bill, begin the process on the floor, since on the committee there's not a similar process, on the floor to declare a conflict of interest, is there a point at which, after declaring that conflict of interest, you can pause or withdraw your request to be excused from the vote? And here's sort of how I get to that question. So as Representative Kopp mentioned, Alaska is a little bit different than some other states. We have, committees in the legislature who only have 5 members. In certain situations, not all 5 of those may be present. So you may have many situations where a single vote will directly impact the district that a representative is here to represent. Unlike, say, New Hampshire, which has about 12 times as many members in their state house. So we're about 12 times as smaller. It would seem to me that one of the reasons our process is the way it is today is so that we don't come into a situation where a district is being deprived of their vote unless we have a very, very good reason for doing so. And so what I'm trying to weigh is if that is the risk, and under your new proposal, it seems to me that there is that risk that you would declare your conflict and then your district would be deprived of vote on committee or on the floor. And so I'm trying to weigh, well, what is the harm that that necessitates that great risk or potential risk? And so my question is there any way under your proposal for I, as a legislator who want to declare a conflict but don't want to disadvantage my district, whom I'm elected to represent, and I don't know that there is, but I am foreseeing a situation where my district may be very, very, hard on an issue, and they want me to vote a certain way, and I have this conflict of interest because, well, it's Alaska, and we all have, conflicts of various types, and I am in deference to my district. I will fail to disclose that that conflict and reap whatever consequences those might be, including perhaps losing an election, perhaps not. But whatever the ethics committee then, might decide for the sake of my district. Because, again, I'm elected here to represent my district, and regardless of whatever, conflicts there are, certainly whatever I'm here to do, it's on their behalf. So, again, my question is, in the process as it is now, can I accomplish what the current status quo is stand up and declare my conflict and yet not be under the impression that there's a very high likelihood my district would be deprived of my vote. Can I do that? Or once I go start down the road of declaring a conflict, is there no point at which I can say, you know, I take this back? Or as was mentioned earlier, I certainly don't have the ability to vote against my own abstention under your proposal. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. Again, this is of the choice of the legislature themselves to rise and declare their conflict of interest. If there's a conflict of interest based on what we're proposing, the hope is that they would rise and they would declare that. In regards to your question of can you take it back mid objection, I think that's something that we would definitely look into and see what that might look like and see how the uniform rules would be affected. But again, I think if you're making a public declaration of an actual honest-to-goodness conflict of interest based on our proposal, that a legislator would have to question themselves if they should be voting on said bill or not. And that would be for them to decide.
Thank you.
I don't see anyone else in the queue. I'm looking around to give them a chance to say what, Sean Wilson. Okay, with those questions being included, we are now ready to open public testimony for House Bill 44 and Concurrent Resolution 1. So I will open the public hearing. And is there anyone in the room or online wishing to testify? I see some hands. Well, you could step back and did you all sign in? Oh, never mind. Here we go. Did the folks raising their hands, did they sign in? I think it's coming. The first that wants to testify is Margot Waring. And if I mispronounce your name, please correct me. I'm nothing intentional on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You did not misspell or mispronounce my name. My name is Margot Waring. I'm here on behalf of the president of the League of Women Voters, and I've been asked to read a letter into the record. Dear Representative Klayman, Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, the League of Women Voters of Alaska urges you to support House Bill 44 and send it on to its next committee of referral. Transparency in government is important to the League at all levels, local, state, and national. When an elected official has a conflict of interest, that official should not be voting on the legislation under consideration. One of democracy's greatest challenges comes when citizens no longer think government represents or cares about them and, in response, fail to participate. We can see this erosion of confidence in the declining numbers of citizens who participate in our elections. Part of what restores confidence is making it clear that legislators do not use their position for personal gain. We applaud the bill's sponsor for seeing that one way to restore confidence is to change the rule that has allowed legislators with a conflict to be excused from voting, from not voting. In this way, voters can be sure that the vote cast is not done for personal benefit. We often hear supporters of the current practice say that to not vote is to deprive a district of its voice. The answer to that is that a vote cast under a cloud also deprives voters of knowing that the vote was cast for the benefit of the district and the state. Again, thank you for giving the League the opportunity to speak in support of a bill that strengthens our democracy Sincerely, Pat Redmond, President.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wang. Anyone have questions? Hold on, don't go too fast. Representative Ledoux has a question.
Ms. Waring, have you, I assume you've been back here in the audience. You probably listened to this back and forth. Do you think this bill goes far enough?
For that, I would only be able to speak as a private citizen and not as representing the League of Women Voters.
I assume you'd like to hear her view as a private citizen.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
My own personal opinion is that the bill does not go far enough.
Thank you.
And follow up. And Representative Rundle, if you do have questions, just speak up to get your name in the queue. I'm not going to call on you each time with the people testifying. Next I have on the list, Fred Treen.
Good afternoon. My name is Fred Treen. I'm an attorney from Petersburg, and I'm here today simply to express my own interest in the bill, and in particular my unalterable opposition to HB 44, although I do support the concurrent resolution, HCR 1. And my opposition is based on a keen interest that I have in constitutional law, and in particular an important principle of our government, and that is the doctrine of separation of powers. And the separation of powers doctrine teaches us that one branch of government should not meddle in the affairs of another branch. And that principle actually extends, it's broader than that. It means that one branch cannot regulate the internal affairs of another branch. So, for instance, if this legislation that is proposed to amend Title 24 were actually proposed to amend Title 22, it would clearly violate the separation of powers doctrine because it would be telling the court system what the court system must do when, in fact, the court system already has its own regulations about recusal of judges for conflict of interest. My objection to HB 44 is based on the notion that it would, if enacted and codified, would transfer from the legislature to the people across the street in the judicial branch the authority to regulate internal affairs within the legislature. Those internal affairs can properly be addressed in the legislature's uniform rules, and amending the uniform rules is certainly completely within the province and power of the legislature. But what the legislature should not do is should not convey to the judicial branch the authority to make decisions about your internal process. This legislation targets 60 people. It's not the thousands and half a million that are residents of our state. And those 60 people are all members of the legislature. They're all subject to the uniform rules, and it's the uniform rules that should address the issue that's presented in HB 44. I just might add as a footnote that if you do go further with the joint resolution, I suggest that the committee should address the two categories of objections or concerns that Representative Ledoux has raised earlier today in amending the, and should be considered when you amend the uniform rules. Another note that I want to add, note capital N, is the fiscal note. And I think the fiscal note really lacks candor. It's not a complete or candid description of the effect or potential effect of this legislation. Because what the fiscal note overlooks is something that frankly is overlooked in a lot of legislation that's considered and sometimes passed by our legislature, and that is the litigation that will be generated and the affect on the judicial branch by the duty of having to decide cases that are sent to it, to the judicial branch, as a result of legislation enacted here. So, for example, if HB 44 is enacted and we have the possibilities that are outlined in the chart, we can see where disputes will arise. And what will an aggrieved person do if a person is adversely affected by or involved in a dispute that's created by this legislation? Well, the person will go across the street and will file a lawsuit, and then some person over there who was planning to have his or her divorce and child custody trial decided will be shunted aside because an emergency petition will come in to a Superior Court judge. There are only two of them over there, and you can take it to Anchorage where you'll have a bigger selection of judges. But the fact remains that if this, if a dispute that arises by the need to interpret this legislation, such a dispute will go to the court system and it will be a burden on our judiciary. And the judiciary should not be involved in deciding issues that are within the province of the legislature. And therein is the ultimate source of my objection, which is the separation of powers doctrine.
And Mr. Treeman, I know we try to keep public testimony to 5 minutes. I'll give you a little bit longer to wind up, but you're at your 5 minutes.
I've just wound up, so I'll ask to be excused unless there are questions.
Mr. Eastman, Representative Eastman, I apologize.
Through the chair. Now, you had mentioned that you shared the two categories of objection that Representative Ledoux had remarked on earlier. For the record, can you just summarize those two categories of objection that you share?
I'll try, although, frankly, I think she'll do a much better job than I will. But I sense that Representative Ledoux has identified a problem that's found or located in the upper right-hand corner of the chart. And the first issue here is that the objection that's made under the current rules, the objector is not identified in the record. So essentially it's a form of anonymous legislation, and I think that offends our notion of a public legislature with accountability. And I have to scratch my head and think. Representative Ledoux also identified another issue in a separate series of questions, and I think I would ask her to send me a lifeline on that one.
Do you need the lifeline from Representative Ledoux, or do you understand the other series of questions she was asking Representative Eastman?
I simply wanted to put it in the record again. If someone could refresh my memory on that.
Representative Ledoux, you want to refresh his memory?
I think I was talking about the soft threshold that I think this bill is a really good start, but I look at the number of things that somebody would either have to declare the conflict on and perhaps not vote. And all I can think is of things that might have been in the capital budget in the old days when we had a capital budget. And under this bill, you still vote on the capital budget. So any little grant that might go to an organization that you might have some interest in, where there might be a conflict under this bill, you wouldn't be, you would be still required to vote on, because that's a budget item. If you are the president of a company which is impacted along with other companies or other unions, and I don't want to target any particular area, but if there is, that let's just say, motor fuel. So if you're the president of an airline, and it's not only impacting your airline, but it's affecting other airlines, then that wouldn't be a conflict. And it would kind of seem to me that that is a conflict. And that's why people, in an excess of precaution, they declare them as conflicts, and then I've actually never seen, and this is my 9th year in the legislature, an instance where somebody declares a conflict and somebody doesn't object. And so no matter what the conflict is, somebody's voting on it. And so that's, of course, the policy question. And it sounds like virtually every other state and municipality has resolved that conflict question differently, and I think preferably to how the state of Alaska is doing it now. So does that answer your question, Representative East?
Thank you very much.
Okay. And Mr. Treem, I know, I'm just looking on my screen and you weren't there. And Mr. Treem, I think that is that the second point you were trying to remember?
Yes, but would I be allowed a follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to invite to the committee's attention that this issue about conflicts of interest comes up all the time in the judicial system. And the judicial system resolves it by a common law rule. It's not in the statutes, other than we have enacted a common law reception statute in Title I. Instead, the judicial branch relies upon the individual judgment and conscience of judicial officers. And I think that the legislature can follow that example. You people, the 60 of you, have consciences, and you can be relied upon to use your own judgment. You do not need this formal rule. So again, I suggest that you should pursue the joint resolution, but please do not enact the HB 44.
And I see Representative Fensler has a follow-up question for you.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Treem, thank you for your testimony. Is it fair to say, though, to summarize what you're saying, that you support this as a adjustment made to the uniform rules, and that's why you believe a change similar to this should be made?
Yes, absolutely yes.
And then just a follow-up to that, if I may. Isn't there still the potential, if it is in the uniform rules, that it would eventually find its way into the judicial system? If there is
less
conflict.
Less likely because, again, of the separation of powers doctrine, and courts are extremely reluctant to mess in the affairs, the internal affairs of other branches of government, in particular in the legislature. So, a person would have a terrible, an extraordinary burden to try to convince a judge, a Superior Court judge, and the Supreme Court thereafter, to decide an issue that really is involves the interpretation of the uniform rules of the Alaska State Legislature.
Okay, I don't see any other follow-up questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Treem. And next in line for public testimony is Douglas Mertz. Mr. Mertz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Douglas Mertz. I'm a longtime resident of Juneau and before that, Fairbanks. For many years, I was an assistant attorney general, and among my duties there was what we usually call the ethics guru, the person in charge of administering the Executive Branch Ethics Act. As a longtime attorney for almost 40 years, I'm also very familiar with the rules of judicial conduct and how they affect judicial conflicts of interest. What I get from that experience is that two-thirds of the branches of government here have the rule that if you have a conflict of interest, you do not take official action. It is only the legislature that has arrogated to itself an exemption from that rule, one that has been noted has for many years resulted in no one being disallowed to vote on particular measures. This is not only the sole exception to the way ethics are administered in Alaska, as has been noted, it's also the exception among the states. The common law of ethics, as Mr. Treem referred to is consistent with the rule in the two other branches of government. If you have a conflict, you don't take official action. Now, the bill as currently drafted in the sponsor substitute still is defective in that it would allow a majority to, in effect, say you have to vote anyway. this is a major exception to the common law rule and to the rule in the other two branches of government, which leads me to question whether the way professional politicians or amateur politicians, elected officials, are held in regard by the public has something to do with the fact that you consider yourselves exempt from the usual ethics rules. So I urge you to go forward with this bill, both of these bills, and to essentially enact the common law rule that if a legislator has a conflict of interest, that legislator may not take official action. You can always tweak the definition of what is a conflict of interest. I think that's fair game. But once you have a conflict of interest, you should not be taking official action.
Representative Ledoux has a question.
So, in the other two bodies, I guess the executive and the judicial.
The branches.
Those branches. So we've been throwing around this idea, if you're working for a company and that company is impacted by legislation, would that be a conflict of interest that you would both need to declare under this bill or need to declare? But under this bill, as it now stands, you'd still vote. How would that work in the other two branches of government?
Through the chair, in those cases, you still have to look at the definition of what a substantial conflict of interest is, what the threshold is. Is it something so minor? Is it something that affects everybody? I don't think, for instance, no judge would recuse himself when he had a question about the permanent fund dividend because everybody gets it. And there are plenty of examples like that. On the other hand, if it has something to do with the employer of the judge's spouse or the executive branch official's spouse that directly affects them but nobody else, all that's on the other side of the ledger. Very difficult to figure out where to draw the line. And I'm not sure that it makes too much sense to try to do it legislatively other than by saying substantial conflict of interest and trying to define it in the very general terms that this proposal does. You can't define it too closely, or by defining it too closely, you leave out situations that later you figure, well, we should have included that too.
Well.
Go ahead.
Just a follow-up. So, I mean, under this bill, the way this is reading now, clearly it would allow the president of a company whose industry is impacted by legislation, but that legislation is not targeted at his specific company, it would clearly allow that person to vote on that piece of legislation.
To the chair, that is correct if whatever the legislation is would impact a substantial number of companies and not just the one.
Which is what this legislation
right,
does.
I think that's what it's trying to do, yes. Make that distinction.
And so, just follow up.
Go ahead.
So, let's say we have a judge, for example, whose husband or wife is president of a company which would be impacted by a judicial decision. How would that work in the legal profession? I'm going to give you an example.
Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, there was some litigation about the constitutionality of some retroactive legislation relating to the real estate profession. Many of the real estate people thought that if a particular piece of legislation was declared unconstitutional, that that would have a significant deleterious effect on everybody in the profession. So if the judge's husband owned a real estate company, would that judge be allowed to vote on that case?
I believe the answer in the judicial branch is that the judge would have to recuse himself or herself. If for no other reason than out of an abundance of caution and to avoid the appearance of impropriety. On the other hand, if the legislation in question or the legal question had to do with application of a tax to all corporations, then it probably wouldn't have that result because it would be such a widespread thing.
Thank you.
And I had one follow-up. Just Mr. Treen presented an analysis that suggests that amending the statutes creates a separation of powers issue, but not changing our uniform rule. Do you concur with his view about a separation of powers issue? Do you not concur, or do you not want to take an opinion on that?
I appreciate Mr. Treen's sensitivity to constitutional issues, but I think he is probably wrong about that.
Well, I'm not sure right or wrong, but your view is that we could amend the statute without creating a conflict, a constitutional or a separation of powers issue. Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Mertz?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The last person I have on the list right now is Ray Metcalf. Mr. Metcalf.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to speak. Just to be clear, I didn't plan on speaking to this committee until I stuck my nose in the door and saw what you're talking about. And I said, I need to have some input there. Just a bit of history.
Oh, I'm sorry. You need to say who you are and if you're affiliated with anyone other than yourself.
My name is Ray Metcalf. I do have a nonprofit that I work with, and it's called Citizens for Ethical Government. I was, just a bit of history, I was the guy that was working with the feds before they busted Vico and jailed six legislators for taking bribes. I was in the legislature in the 70s and the 80s, and it was obvious to me that bribery was rampant. And this is an issue I've been very interested in ever since. I watched a chairman of the finance committee in the Senate with partners buy a pipeline camp and try to then sell it back to the state to be a private prison or to be a prison. He bought it for $300 and tried to sell it back for $3 million, and he was the one that put the money in the finance committee bill. So I've seen another legislator move a certificate of need to her family. I've seen another legislator take a $10,000 payment to assist a private organization in getting appropriations, and they performed. These are commonplace. It happens more often than you know. With the conflict of interest issue, Thomas Jefferson wrote the first one that I know of, in this country at least. When in 1801 he wrote that for the rules for the U.S. Senate, and if you were a member of the U.S. Senate and you had, quote, and I trust me on the quote, I don't know the exact, but if you had any interest whatsoever in the issue before you, you not only had to not vote, you had to withdraw. You had to leave the room. And fast forward here a few years, The same U.S. Supreme Court that gave us Citizens United also gave us a way to fix it. And a lot of people aren't paying much attention. In the state of Nevada, there was a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was over ethics. And to make a long story short, a guy helped somebody get elected. He was the campaign manager. And when he got him elected, he then brought his best friend in and said, hey, this is my best friend, and he needs a gaming permit. Well, in Nevada, that's a big deal. So he thought about it a little bit and said, I could probably help with that. And so he helped get this guy a gaming permit. And someone looked at their Nevada conflict of interest statute, which is totally broad, just can be applied to almost anything. And it simply says, if you have a conflict, you may not vote. It's not quite that simple, but that's effectively what it says. And so they put this in front of a jury, and before it was all done, and the jury said, you know, you did this person a favor, even though it was one step removed, it was something that you did for this person, because you wouldn't have done that for me if I'd have walked in the door, knowing you, not knowing me from Adam. You did it to repay this man for the work he did on your campaign as a favor. And he was convicted. And then this went to the Nevada Supreme Court. And for all those reasons that any freshman attorney, fresh out of college, would think, the Supreme Court of Nevada overturned it. They overturned the conviction. They said, you know, that violates his free speech, it violates his obligation to represent his constituents, you probably know the rest. So for all those reasons, they threw it out. The Nevada, state of Nevada then took that to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court slammed the Nevada court on a 9-0 decision. It's the one of the few things they all agreed on. That speech didn't belong to him. It belonged to his constituents. They said, the statute in the state of Nevada has said, under these circumstances, you cannot vote, therefore you cannot vote. And then there is the Vico deal.
You have about 15 seconds on your 5 minutes.
I'll be happy to answer. I've heard a bunch of reasons for objection, and I've been working on this stuff for many years. I'll be happy to answer any objections I've heard about this kind of legislation and how it would affect people.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any questions from the committee. Thank you very much for coming and testifying today. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify either online or here in the committee room? Did you sign up, or we just haven't had you sign? Okay. Please.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for not signing up. My name is John Pugh, and I'm here just as a citizen living in Juneau.
And last name is P-U-G-H?
P-U-G-H.
Thank you. Okay.
I would like to just comment real quickly on two things that I think are really important, not specifically on the bill. I think that you have gone through the bill and made a lot of analysis and questions about the bill. But two things that I think are really important for the citizens of Alaska, and they go towards the issue of transparency. The first thing is that right now I think people are in the legislature are erring on the side of whenever there's a perceived conflict, most people stand up and say that I'm a member of a union or I work for an oil company or whatever else. I would hope that that continues and that this bill doesn't suppress the fact that people do err on the side of saying that this is maybe a perceived conflict, if not in my district and across the state. So I think that's really important to not have this bill somehow suppress people not standing up when they think there may be at least a perceived conflict. So I think that's important as you move forward. The second thing that has already been mentioned but not talked about a lot is the idea of putting it on the record. That is transparency. Why we don't have it on the record is a mystery to me, because I think that's what's really important as well, is so that citizens can go and look at the record and be able to see who declared that they might have a conflict of interest or perceived conflict of interest. So I think those two things, as you move forward, if you put those in context, making sure that this doesn't have that the idea that we might actually suppress would be, I think, less transparency. So I think making sure that we don't suppress the legislators from standing up and really kind of looking at it and saying, I think I have a perceived conflict here because I'm a member of union, whatever, is very important.
Okay. Can't leave yet. Representative Libby has a question.
Thank you. I was just wondering whether you feel it's appropriate that the objection also be put on the record. Who objected?
Yes, I think that the record should be the record, and I think this is it's part of the legislative process, and I think that that's very important that it go on the record.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Pugh? I don't see any. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else, either in the room or online or on the telephone, who would like to testify on House Bill 44 and House Concurrent Resolution 1? Hearing and seeing no one, the public hearing is closed. Are there further questions? Let me actually just say a couple of things. First, I will ask further questions, but after those questions, before we get to 3 o'clock, I thought we would take a very short recess to just concur amongst ourselves to figure out where we're going. I would just say there's been a lot of questions. I have a sense there may be some interest in amending the bill. My original plan had been to have this bill heard on Monday and vote it up or down, but my sense is that with the discussion, we no longer know what time we'll take that on the break, but I know that Representative Eastman has a question that I think he wants Mr. Gardner to answer.
Yes, is Mr. Gardner still on the phone?
Okay. No, he's not online anymore.
Okay. Well, I will have a question for him whenever that can be asked.
Okay, well, why don't we, any other questions we can take up right now, or should we take a 5-minute break and try to get Doug Gardner back online during the break? Okay, we're gonna take a 5-minute break. Do I need the gavel out? Okay, we're gonna take a brief at ease. We'll be back in 5. I understand that Doug Gardner is back on the line. Mr. Gardner?
Representative Klayman, I am back on the line. I apologize. When you went to some public testimony, I thought I was off the hook.
Well, you were certainly off the hook for public testimony. Representative Eastman has a question for you. So, Representative Eastman.
Through the chair, Mr. Gardner, I wanted to ask, are there constitutional prohibitions in our state constitution against the types of bills that the legislature might pass? And where I'm going with that is many of the circumstances that were being discussed in testimony earlier today dealt with issues that, you know, we might not necessarily expect to come before the legislature, or examples that, you know, may not have had a lot of historical precedent, and I'm just wondering if there are any larger prohibitions at the constitutional level, perhaps, that prohibit, you know, some of these types of conflict of interest situations from ever taking place in the form of a bill.
Mr. Gardner.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I listened carefully to what you said, and I apologize for not having some of the background with if that was what came out in the public testimony. Obviously, the legislature, if it passes a bill that's unconstitutional, you know, if you passed a bill that eliminated the right to jury trials in criminal cases, then, you know, obviously it's unconstitutional. So clearly there are constitutional limits on what the legislature can do, and as you know, it's the function of the court to make the call on whether something is a statute is unconstitutional. But I'm not sure. You need to maybe give me a little bit more specifics in the context of this bill, what your concern is.
Representative Eastman.
Mr. Gardner, I'm not thinking in the context of that quite broad of a situation. I'm wondering, are there any more specific types of legislation, an ex post facto law, a bill of attainder, for example, something that works corruption of blood? Are any of those kinds of prohibitions imposed upon the state legislature as a branch of government by our state constitution?
Uh,
you're looking for, to the chair, you're looking for an example of a situation where there's a constitutional restriction on the legislature, on legislators. Is that correct, Representative?
Yes. I'm wondering if, you know, what those might be, if any.
Well, I think the one that comes to mind, I suppose, could be the restriction that the legislature has on local and special legislation. I mean, you're not going to be able to local or special acts in Article 2, Section 19. You can't pass a bill that has simply a local, you know, benefits a particular community or something. The bills all have to have statewide application. And so, yes, you are restricted. I'm trying to track the question, but if I think I've got it right, yes, you do have a restriction on what the legislature can do in certain circumstances, and that one comes to mind.
So, Representative Eastman, I'm not sure if you got followed, but it seems pretty far afield from the topic of this bill.
That's what I wanted. Thank you very much, Mr.
Gardner. Okay. All right. Anyone else have questions for Mr. Gardner? Seeing no one else. What we're going to do right now, this is, actually, I will give one last chance. Mr. Johnston, any further comments on behalf of the bill presenter?
Ryan Johnston, staff representative Jason Grin. I just want to say Jason had to leave for finance, but he extends a thank you for allowing him to present today, and looks forward to working with the committee on the bill.
Thank you. So where we are, this is scheduled for hearing on Monday. I get the sense from the testimony and the questions and the comments made by different members of the committee that there'll probably be some discussions with members of the committee as well as Representative Grimm's office about potential amendments. I know that Representative Eastman has already dropped a potential amendment off at my office, and I would encourage you to discuss that amendment with Representative Grimm as well. We will keep it on the calendar for Monday. I would suggest there's a good possibility that we will either hear it for a very short time on Monday and give the committee a little more time to review these things with Representative Grimm. The exact scheduling will keep you posted, but it's certainly something we can take up on bills previously heard at any of the different hearings we've got scheduled for this committee. So I think that's everything. We will hold House Bill 44 and House Concurrent Resolution 1 at this time for further review, and we'll stand adjourned at, it looks like, 2:53.